Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's oral arguments in the Supreme Court in the case of Abu Zubaydah, in what is seen as a test case on state secrets, since Zubaydah has tried to subpoena two CIA contractors in a Polish case investigating CIA black sites. The U.S. government has blocked the subpoenas based on the claim that information could be released that would harm national security, an argument the justices did not seem to buy since the sites are public knowledge and have been closed down. The lawyer representing Abu Zubaydah, Joe Margulis, professor of law and government at Cornell University, a civil rights attorney and critic of the national security state, and the author of What Changed When Everything Changed, 9/11 and the Making of National Identity, and Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power, joins us. Having been in limbo at Guantanamo for decades, Abu Zubaydah was held in CIA black sites, and his interrogation in 2002 and 2003 prompted the Bush administration to draft the infamous torture memos. We'll discuss the frustration the Supreme Court justices expressed at the U.S. government's lawyer today for not letting Zubaydah testify in person, and how the two CIA contractors in the case have agreed to testify but are not allowed to. Then we'll examine the ongoing ecological damage from the devastating oil spill on the Southern California coast and speak with Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, whose latest column is, "We Learned Nothing from Previous Oil Spills. Will we learn from this one?" He joins us to discuss how lessons have not been learned from the oldest major coastal disaster in modern history, the Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969, which prompted the formation of Earth Day, and how government regulators only inspect the 18,000 miles of abandoned pipelines, not the ones operating today. Then finally, we'll speak with Karim Zidane, an investigative journalist who covers the intersection of sports and politics. He has written for The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Deadspin, Bleacher Report, and SB Nation, and has an article at Right Wing Watch, "Neo-Nazis Trained for Combat in Growing Active Club Movement." We'll discuss how angry young white men and boys are being attracted to mixed martial arts and fight clubs, which have become incubators for far-right hyper-masculinity. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Joe Margulis, who is a professor of law and government at Cornell University, a civil rights attorney and critic of the national security state. He's the author of What Changed When Everything Changed, 9/11 and the Making of National Identity, and Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. He's the counsel on record for Razul versus Bush involving detentions at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Station and in Guerin versus Omar and Manouf versus Guerin involving detentions at Camp Cropper in Iraq. And he's currently representing Abu Zubaydah, who was held in CIA black sites and whose interrogation in 2002 and 2003 prompted the Bush administration to draft the infamous torture memos. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Margulis.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And are you still representing Abu Zubaydah? Because the Supreme Court discussed his case today.
I sure am. And I was listening with great interest to the argument.
And in fact, some of the Supreme Court justices were wondered why Abu Zubaydah himself was not testifying.
Yeah, I kind of wonder that, too. And I wish the government would allow it. We've, of course, as you probably know, and as your listeners probably know, everything that Abu Zubaydah says is presumptively classified at the top secret level. So if he were to say to me what happened to him at various black sites, I can't repeat it to the world unless I first give it to the CIA for clearance and redaction. And we have given over 100 pages of letters from our client that they have yet, years ago, that they have yet to clear. So it's a very interesting idea that finally Abu Zubaydah be allowed to testify. We'd love that.
So walk us through the stages that took this case to the Supreme Court, because it went from the, I guess it was the Ninth Circuit, and then it went to the Supreme Court?
Yes, right. So this case arose ultimately out of an investigation that's taking place in Poland by Polish prosecutors into whether crimes were committed in Poland in connection with the black site that existed there. And Polish prosecutors asked us to get information from James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who were the architects of the torture program, about what they saw and heard and did in Poland to Abu Zubaydah when he was held there. So we sought that discovery. There's a U.S. statute that allows that in support of this Polish prosecution. Mitchell and Jessen said they were more than happy to testify. The problem is not with them. The administration intervened and asserted that any information that they would give about the black site in Poland, about what they did, is a state secret. The Ninth Circuit disagreed and said that the case could go forward. The government sought review in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court agreed to hear it, and oral argument was today.
But how could it be secret if the Senate did a report that found Zubaydah had been interrogated, and that included 83 instances of waterboarding, sleep deprivation for 11 days, confinement in a box-like coffin, etc.? All of this stuff is on the record. I mean, he was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002 and apparently taken to these black sites in both Thailand and Poland.
That's right. That's right.
Where are the secrets? Because this is pretty much public knowledge, isn't it, all of this stuff?
Yes, it's common knowledge, with one exception. We know a great deal about what happened to Abu Zubaydah at the black site in Thailand. That's where we know about the 83 episodes of waterboarding and so on, the confinement in the box. We know a great deal less. In fact, there isn't testimony about what happened to him in Poland. The Polish prosecutor knows there was a site in Poland. He knows where it was. He knows when it was there. What he doesn't know is what happened inside it. There isn't testimony on the record about what happened inside Abu Zubaydah's cell. And there were only three people present: Mitchell, Jessen, and Abu Zubaydah. And Abu Zubaydah can't testify. So there's only two ways we can get that information. One is from Mitchell and one is from Jessen.
And you said they both are willing to testify.
Absolutely. When we sought the request, they said they had no objection to it. This is the first the Trump administration and then the Biden administration putting the kibosh on it.
But during the Supreme Court's oral arguments today, the U.S. government lawyer, Brian Fletcher, when he was asked about this being public knowledge, he said that the U.S. government had given its word to Poland to keep the information confidential. So that elicited a very skeptical response from Justice Elena Kagan, who said it's a little bit farcical to use state secrets privilege to protect something that no longer exists, meaning this secret site in Poland.
That's right. And it is farcical. But even if the word Poland were a secret, it doesn't really matter, because we're not asking them to repeat the word Poland. As I said, the Polish prosecutor knows there was a site there and he knows when it was there. We're just asking them to talk about what they did inside the site. And if they never mention the word Poland, that's fine.
Well, going back to some of the other questions by some of the other Supreme Court justices expressing frustration that the U.S. has limited Zubaydah's ability to testify on his own behalf. Is that to do with the fact that the government simply doesn't want anything in the public record that may seem like a justification for al-Qaeda's actions?
Oh, the government doesn't even say, even the government doesn't allege that Abu Zubaydah is associated with Al-Qaeda. They've long since given up any claim that he was ever a member of Al-Qaeda, that he had anything to do with 9/11. That's what they said when they wanted to torture him. But they subsequently confirmed that they were mistaken about him. I think the reason the government doesn't want, the government has never wanted anyone at Guantanamo to be able to give their account of what was done to them unfiltered by U.S. censors. It is never, ever allowed that. From the very beginning, everybody at Guantanamo can only speak through U.S. censors. That is, you can talk to a lawyer. Well, we won that right back in 2004 to talk to a lawyer, but that lawyer can't turn around and repeat what the person said. Instead, the lawyer has to give it to the CIA, who gets to review it line by line and redacts what it doesn't want out there. And they've never wavered from that.
But the government, the U.S. government, is still insisting that Abu Zubaydah is a terrorist recruiter, right?
No, the government does not assert that he has any connection to Al-Qaeda. If he has, I guess the best way to put it is this. If they think he has done something wrong, we welcome them charging him. He has never been charged since the day he's been brought there. We have sought his charges because it would give us an opportunity to defend against anything that there, and there's never been anything. He is uncharged, and as far as we know, he will always be uncharged.
So you're his lawyer, then what have you been told he's guilty of? What are you defending?
Welcome to the world of Guantanamo cases. We're not defending against anything. There are no charges against him. He's being held without charge. We have sought his release. There has been a habeas petition seeking his release that was filed. I've represented him in that since 2007. I think that document was filed in 2008. It's 13, 14 years old, and it remains pending. It's a travesty. It's a travesty.
Well, it's very Kafkaesque or Orwellian, isn't it? I mean,
Kafkaesque is what it is. It really is. It really is Kafkaesque. Uh-huh. I mean, that expression is overused. But in a case like this, it's accurate.
Right. So in your discussions with your client, Abu Zubaydah, has he ever said what he's done or has he proclaimed his innocence?
Well, I can't tell you what he says, mm-hmm. Because anything he tells me is classified. I can tell you what he has said in other contexts. Which the government has allowed. That is, he was opposed to 9/11. He thinks 9/11 was a travesty. Actually, I shouldn't say opposed to it in the sense that he knew it before. He didn't know it was going to happen. But when it did, he thought it was an abomination. He's ideologically opposed to Al-Qaeda, not allied with Al-Qaeda. ISIS, for instance, he thinks is just appalling, and the abuses of civilians that ISIS engages in, he thinks is just a gross misuse of Islam. I can tell you that all of that has been cleared for release.
I see. But doesn't that undercut the government's case?
We think so. And we have said as much in court for several years.
And he's been in detention for over a decade, right?
Oh, yeah. He was first arrested at a home in Pakistan in March of 2002 and thrown into a black site in late March. He was held in black sites from late March of 2002 until September of 2006, various sites. And he's been at Guantanamo without interruption since September 2006.
And he could be there for a lot longer, right? I mean, it's a place for limbo, isn't it? I mean, That's right.
And all we know is that before his detention, or rather before his interrogation started, before his torture started, the CIA sent a cable from the site in Thailand, which was the site of the first black site, saying, look, before we get underway with these torture techniques, we're all in agreement here that Abu Zubaydah will be held incommunicado for the rest of his life and will never see the light of day, right? And the CIA headquarters sent a cable back saying, yes, everybody's on the same page about that. So that's been their goal since they started torturing him in August of 2002.
And these two contractors that the CIA hired to do the torture, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, were paid, what, some 80-something million dollars, weren't they not?
That's right. I think it was $81 million. Their company was paid $81 million.
And they have no qualifications in, not that there are necessarily that many qualified torturers out there.
They don't even have any law enforcement qualifications. They'd never conducted a real interrogation before. They don't speak Arabic. They had no familiarity with Al-Qaeda. They had no knowledge of transnational terrorism. They're utterly unqualified.
Well, I thank you for joining us. This is an extraordinary story. And I guess Kafkaesque is the best description, right?
That's right. Not at all, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Joe Margulies, who is a professor of law and government at Cornell University, a civil rights attorney and critic of the national security state. He's the author of What Changed When Everything Changed, 9/11 and the Making of National Identity, and Guantanamo and the Abuses of Presidential Power. He's a counsel on record in Razul versus Bush involving detentions at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station and Guren versus Omar and Manouf versus Guren, involving detentions at Camp Cropper in Iraq, and he's currently represents Abu Zubaydah, who was held in CIA black sites and whose interrogations in 2002 and 2003 prompted the Bush administration to draft the infamous torture memos. We're going to take a B-station break and back examining the ongoing ecological damage from the devastating oil spill on the Southern California coast.
Yeah. I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry and currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, The New Deal, A Modern History, and Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. And his latest column at the Los Angeles Times is We Learn Nothing from Previous Oil Spills. Will we learn from this one? Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the oil spill you're referring to started, at least as much as we know, on Friday, October the 1st, if not earlier, off the coast of Huntington Beach and Newport Beach. It is now spoiled, I don't know how many miles of coastline. We don't know how many shorebirds and marine creatures have been killed, but we do know that it's gotten into the Talbot Marsh and these very important ecosystems and wetlands that have been poisoned. So this is not the first time, as your article points out. There was the Santa Barbara oil spill in 1969 that actually prompted the formation of Earth Day, and then the Refugio Beach oil spill in 2015. So let's begin with what we know about the cause of this, since there seems to be some doubt about it. What caused the breach in that pipeline? Was it an anchor being dragged by these many big container ships that are piling up outside of Long Beach and Los Angeles Harbor that are sort of out there and within that area?
That seems to be the suspicion, at least from from authorities who are looking at the site. What we do know is that this was a pipeline that was basically on the seafloor. It ran from this drilling platform 5 or 6 miles offshore to a pumping station in Long Beach. And it was ruptured. It was damaged in some way. And there's also suspicion that the alarm systems that were supposed to be in place to let operators know that pressure had plummeted, which would indicate a break. There's some question as to whether they were working adequately and when they actually sounded, if at all. So there is still a lot of questions, but we certainly know enough to know that this is a consequence of the practice of extracting oil from beneath the ocean floor and transporting it underwater to land.
Well, surely we would have learned about that from the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf, which was a catastrophic oil spill. And I would have thought that subsequent to that, there would have been more regulations or at least more scrutiny.
Well, one would think that. You know, and I should say, by the way, that the Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969 that you referred to, that itself was not the first spill of its nature offshore California. I mean, almost since the beginning of oil extraction in California, really at the turn of the last century, there have been accidents and spills, certainly not all as consequential as these last few ones or the Deepwater Horizon, but significant enough to be recorded. So we've known really for more than 100 years that transporting oil really in any way has dangers associated with it, and our regulations simply have not kept up with it, and certainly the enforcement of regulations has not kept up with the need.
Well, the similarities, of course, that you point out in the article with the oil spill in Santa Barbara, again, that prompted the formation of Earth Day, that was Union Oil Company's well. Its owner, again, just like the owners of this oil pipeline, Beta Operating Company, which is a subsidiary of Amplify, in both cases, they were pretty late in acknowledging it had happened. And apparently there's equipment that shows a pressure drop in a pipeline right away. So was there a lag in turning off the pipeline?
There was certainly a lag in alerting the authorities so that there could be an official technical response. As you said, the signs are that the pipeline ruptured sometime in the afternoon or evening of Friday, October 1st. Amplify, which is the sort of small oil company that owns and operates the platform and the pipeline, they say they weren't aware of this until Saturday morning, and it was after that point that they alerted authorities. Of course, by then, the oil sheen was visible on the surface of the ocean offshore. So something was known, but of course the magnitude of the spill wasn't really known until the authorities had a way to really assess it. That required the owners to let them know that something had happened. So yeah, in 1969, it was hours, in a certain sense, days before Union Oil really came clean, so to speak, and revealed that they had a major spill, even though it's Union Oil's own personnel were aware that there was something catastrophic going on near their platforms, because they could see geysers of oil and mud coming up, over the surface of the ocean, really very, very close to the platform. So, yeah, so delay in alerting authorities, that seems to be an endemic problem. Minimizing the magnitude of the spill, that happened in 1969. It may have happened again this time around. So that's an endemic problem. And basically, official crossing of fingers that whatever the spill is, it's going to go out to sea rather than end up on shore where it fouls beaches and kills shorebirds and marine creatures. That's endemic too. There's always this hope that, well, maybe it won't be that bad because currents and winds are sending it away. That didn't happen in 1969. That hasn't happened in the last few days either.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, The New Deal, A Modern History, and Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. And his latest column at the Los Angeles Times is, We Learn Nothing from Previous Oil Spills, Will We Learn from This One? And as you and your colleagues at the Los Angeles Times have dug into the kind of provenance of these companies and their history, it's pretty murky, isn't it? The oil platform is operated by the Beta Operating Company, which is a subsidiary of Amplify. And Beta used to be a subsidiary of a Bakersfield company called Era Energy, which is co-owned by ExxonMobil and Shell Oil. But then they divested themselves of it. And then Era sold Beta's oil field interest in 2007 to a company that went bankrupt. And then Beta's owner emerged from bankruptcy as Amplify. And Amplify lost $464 million in 2020 on revenues of $202 million in the first half of the year. The company lost another $54.4 million. So if this is a company in financial distress, and we can get into why that's the case, Michael, it would seem to me that they might be cutting corners.
I think that's a reasonable assumption. I would say that the history of the ownership here isn't murky so much, but it is as it's involved. And you laid out, as I did in my column, the sort of life cycle of this. And the main point that I wanted to make in doing so was that it wasn't so long ago that this operation that's now caused all this problem was in the hands of a couple of big companies that had billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue and billions of dollars in assets and billions of dollars in profits. So they were well positioned to make sure that all the maintenance necessary was being done. They had some sensitivity to the safety implications of what they were doing. Well, now it's in the hands of a company that's basically a money-losing operation, and that by the statements of its own management is really focused on sending money back to and up to its shareholders more than actually operating the oil field in a safe way. And one of the problems that we know we've had in this country in terms of the regulation of the oil extraction industry is that enforcement is really sketchy. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has said so. Basically, regulators have allowed the industry to regulate itself. They haven't inspected facilities anywhere near the degree that needs to be done. And this is what happens when you basically allow a dangerous industry to go on its merry way without really responding to regulatory requirements and initiatives. Here's a company that owns and operates this platform and a pipeline in a sensitive place that talks more about paying dividends to its shareholders than it does about operating in the public interest. And I think that's something that we've seen. I mean, ExxonMobil and Shell Oil essentially divested itself of this platform and the pipeline 10 or 13 years ago because they didn't want to be responsible for the expense of a very capital intensive part of their business. And they also saw that strictly petroleum assets were not being seen very favorably by the stock market. So they got rid of them, and they they left them in the hands of companies that really are in business to squeeze these assets until they can't do that anymore. And that's inimical to the idea that they need to be operated safely.
And Shell, who divested themselves of this companies behind this oil platform that this pipe is leaking as we speak. I mean, actually, they cut it off, but the damage is still not totally known. And it's so far, it's quite catastrophic, according to the mayor of Huntington Beach. Shell, who of course were responsible for the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, they reported revenues of $180.5 billion and profits of $5.6 billion last year, as you point out in your article, Michael. Let's talk about the lax oversight from the government itself. The part of the government that's supposed to be conducting oversight, which they've then handed off to the companies themselves, it's a bit like the FDA, right? They have the big pharma tests the drugs. And we've certainly had some problems in that regard, particularly with OxyContin. But the Interior Department's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement are responsible for the, 18,000 miles of abandoned pipelines? And then I don't know how many thousand of miles of operating pipelines they're responsible for. But they basically slough that off onto the industry? Is that how it works? Or doesn't work, I guess?
I think that's, I mean, the FDA, to its credit, at least, it does leave the pharmaceutical industry basically to conduct its own clinical trials of products that they want to bring to market. But they do have to bring the data that they develop back to the FDA before the FDA signs off on a new drug or a new indication for an old drug. In this case, this is the Interior Department, as you said, Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, really just allows the oil and gas industry to leave its abandoned pipelines underwater. They don't confirm to any reasonable extent, I would say, that the pipelines have been properly cleaned out and decommissioned. And, of course, that begs the question of what's going on with active pipelines like this one. And the GAO, in its report, says that the Interior Department Bureau doesn't conduct or require subsea inspections of active pipelines like this. It just relies on the owners to maintain warning systems. And, of course, if those systems fail, then a disaster can develop under everybody's eyes, and we won't know about it until it's too late. And that there's every possibility that that's what's happened here.
So your article tells a sort of sorry history of going back to the Santa Barbara oil spill in 1969, of how the Nixon administration was completely in bed with big oil. And I think, what was it, 5 out of the 11 members of this panel that Nixon set up to investigate the oil spill had relationships with Union Oil, and the then governor of the state of California, Ronald Reagan, didn't even bother to visit Santa Barbara and inspect the disastrous, fouled shoreline.
Reagan, of course, was also beholden to a lot of oil executives here in California. These were in the days when California was even more of a major producer of oil than it is now. And, the big money for political campaigns in this state, much of it came from executives in the oil industry or business leaders who had financial or professional connections to the oil industry. So we saw that Nixon, of course, and Republicans, and I'm sure Democrats as well, hundreds of thousands of dollars in political contributions from the oil industry. It was the biggest game in town, the biggest business in the United States in that era. And since you mentioned that, I've written about the railroad industry, in the 19th century, you saw the same thing, that it was hard to actually create a regulatory regime that didn't involve conflicts of interest with railroad executives then. And it's been hard to create a regulatory regime over the oil industry that's free of conflicts of interest with oil companies and the oil industry itself. So once again, this is an endemic problem with regulating a big, rich industry, and we see the consequences. We've been seeing these consequences for 50 years just in this state alone, and really across the nation.
Right, but as your article points out, Michael, Reagan tried to open up more of federal lands, particularly offshore, to oil and gas drilling, and local authorities and the Congress thwarted him. And then basically it's been a standoff until Donald Trump came along in 2018, and he tried to open up 98% of coastal waters to new leases, including California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Mercifully, that was also blocked by local politicians. So at this point, in response to what we're talking about here that is happening as we speak along the coast of Southern California with this latest oil spill, Jared Huffman, a Democratic congressman from San Rafael, and Senator Dianne Feinstein have introduced a bill banning oil and gas drilling in federal waters off the coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. Just in closing, what do you think the chances of that are getting fast-tracked?
Well, I suppose there's some possibility, but I'm not sure I would put money on the likelihood. It is true, it's fair to say that the oil industry, the oil and gas industry today, doesn't quite have the clout that it had in 1969 or even 2015. It's viewed much more skeptically because there's more doubt that there's a future for big oil as we go to electrification of our transport sector, electric cars and what have you, and also as everybody, really Democrats and Republicans, become more sensitive to the consequences of global warming, which is so closely tied to the burning of fossil fuels. But this is an industry that's still enormous. It's still, as we've been talking about, the biggest companies collect hundreds of billions of dollars a year in revenues, and they're not shy about deploying it for their own political ends. So it's going to be tough. Dianne Feinstein has been fighting offshore drilling really for virtually all of her career on Capitol Hill. And, you know, she's still fighting it. So, you know, maybe she'll have a better chance of getting this legislation through now, but it's an uphill battle.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and currently he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, The New Deal, A Modern History, and Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. And his latest column at the Los Angeles Times is, We Learn Nothing from Previous Oil Spills, Will We Learn from This One? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how angry young white men and boys are being attracted to mixed martial arts and fight clubs, which have become incubators for far-right hypermasculinity.
Excuse me, mister, but is there natural oil in the sea? And the pollution in the air, mister, whose could that be? So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too, and you're giving mister a bad name, mister like.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Karim Zidane, who is an investigative journalist who covers the intersection of sports and politics. He's written for The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Deadspin, Bleacher Report, and SB Nation. And he has an article at Right Wing Watch, Neo-Nazis Trained for Combat in Growing Active Club Movement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Karim Zidane.
Thank you for having me on, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this idea that neo-Nazis are involved in these mixed martial arts clubs and competitions is quite disturbing. But it occurs to me that quite recently, President Trump, former President Trump and his son Don Jr. did the live narration, or whatever you want to call it, blow-by-blow coverage of a mixed martial arts event So is there a coincidence there, since Trump controls the Republican Party and is clearly very soft on neo-Nazis, to say the least?
Oh, I wouldn't say that there is a direct correlation, but indirectly, yes, it's beneficial to all entities involved. So Donald Trump, yes, was involved in the commentary team for a boxing event called Triller. And interestingly enough, and ironically, to say the least, it was his least animated and least political display we've seen since he became president in 2016. So it was really interesting seeing him being on a boxing, calling a boxing event and mainly talking about boxing rather than talking about politics. Of course, there was the occasional political jab here or there. But really, the main question that we can get out of this is, why was Donald Trump involved in this boxing event to begin with? And the answer is quite simple, is that a significant portion of his audience happens to enjoy combat sports. We've seen combat sports, especially mixed martial arts and the UFC, grow in popularity amongst conservative base in general. UFC president Dana White has been a mainstay on programs such as Tucker Carlson's show, and has talked to all sorts of Candace Owens, regular on Fox News. So you can sense already that these sports are quite popular amongst the conservative base, and particularly amongst Trump's MAGA base. We've seen that a lot in the UFC, and it's quite prevalent throughout mixed martial arts. But the correlation between mainstream mixed martial arts and these active clubs and fascist fight clubs, so to speak, is not a direct one. Sure, there are overall connections in the fact that, the sport is popular amongst, these violent people as well as amongst normal, everyday, working class citizens. But it goes a little deeper than that. These fascist fight clubs are started necessarily generally by white supremacists who are keen to recruit disenfranchised youth to their cause and train them in preparedness for physical fitness and for a coming political or civil revolution or something of the sort. Now, Donald Trump participating in a boxing event and doing the commentary is as much for his ego as it is to pander towards that audience. So is there a direct link? No, but is it something worth telling a story about and worth explaining in detail? Absolutely.
So tell us more about this person who appears on Fox. You just mentioned her.
Oh, that's Dana White. So Dana White is the owner of the UFC, or at least the president of the UFC right now, which is owned by Endeavor, which is the talent agency owned by Ari Emanuel, who is himself a Hollywood super agent and was the agent for Donald Trump during Trump's time and when Trump was doing his own reality TV show. And this is also the same person who bought the Miss Universe pageant from Trump eventually. So Trump's relationship to Dana White and to Ari Emanuel, the super agent, is longstanding. So the UFC has, for the most part, since Donald Trump's presidency, played a role of the sports arm, really, of Trump's presidency. On many occasions, UFC president Dana White has campaigned for Donald Trump, including at the 2016 Republican National Convention and again at the 2020 Republican National Convention. A lot of it was using a lot of, Donald Trump's dog whistles and his political statements, such as, attacking the Black Lives Matter, demonstrations that were taking place throughout the summer, referring to them as riots, etc. That was sort of the same language that Dana White was embracing in his speeches promoting Donald Trump. So the relationship between mixed martial arts and Dana White and Donald Trump is very significant.
And what is Dana White's group, UFC? Did you tell me what that means?
The UFC is the Ultimate Fighting Championship, which is the leading and the most significant MMA mixed martial arts organization in the world right now.
And this is prone to sort of white supremacist ideology. I mean, give us a sense of how they're attracting these disaffected young white supremacists. I take it it's a common recruiting. I mean, the way that Scientologists recruit disaffected young people on Hollywood Boulevard, get them off drugs and get them onto their drug. There seems a similarity here that they try to appeal to the idea of fitness and cleanliness and the purity of your body, etc. Isn't that what's going on?
Absolutely, but I have to emphasize that it's not the UFC that's undergoing this. Other entities, other white supremacists around the world, we're talking about entities in Russia, in Germany, in France, in the United States, are seeing things like the UFC's popularity these days. The UFC happens to be quite a popular sport, and mixed martial arts is very common and mainstream at this point. They are seeing this popularity and trying to take advantage of it and to weaponize it for their own gain. This is not the UFC's doing, but the doing of extremists such as, you know, Robert Rundo in the United States, who is behind these fascist fight clubs, such as the Rise Above movement, which was very significant over the past few years, having taken part in violent encounters during protests in Huntington Beach, Berkeley, Charlottesville. You know, these active clubs that are sprouting all across North America right now fall into that as well. This idea that mixed martial arts is extremely popular amongst the youth has been very significant and has been weaponized because they take this mentality of this hyper-masculinity involved in mixed martial arts, couple that with, you know, the physical fitness, the preparedness, this idea that you can build new identities and form identities in these new brotherhoods and these links bonding you together. This is very common in mixed martial arts spaces. So white supremacists have been able to take that and weaponize it and create their own spaces using it. And that's what these active clubs and fascist fight clubs are.
And again, I'm speaking with Karim Zidan, who's an investigative journalist who covers the intersection of sports and politics. He has written for The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Deadspin, Bleacher Report, and SB Nation, and he has an article at Right Wing Watch, Neo-Nazis Trained for Combat in Growing Active Club Movement. So let's talk more about Robert Rundo and the group that he's founded, Rise Above Movement, or RAM. He has a pretty strong pedigree in right-wing violence, right? I mean, Charlottesville, you mentioned. But he was also prominent in the violent attacks by right wingers on students at Berkeley, what, back in 2017, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So the Rise Above movement. So Robert Rundo was not very, and he says this in his own words. He's posted plenty of videos online, and after, you know, analyzing all of them, it's easy to come to these conclusions, which is that Robert Rundo was very dissatisfied by the representations of the alt-right and the far-right that existed at the time, such as, say, Richard Spencer. He didn't really believe in, you know, the suit and tie look that Richard Spencer was doing. He believed in creating these fitness clubs. And that's what he really did. He created this little boys club of hyper-masculine, violent thugs, really, called them the Rise Above movement. So at the end of the day, they are simply a white supremacist group, and it referred to themselves as the premier mixed martial arts club of the alt-right. So that's really how they branded themselves in the beginning. And they really started making headlines when they took part in these violent encounters at Huntington Beach, and exactly as you mentioned, the student rallies at Berkeley, and of course at, you know, the Unite the Right white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. So they would dress in these skull masks and would be specialized basically in attacking protesters and then glorifying their antics afterwards in these propaganda videos they post on social media. So they became very popular amongst these, you know, these young MAGA people and these young right wingers that were on the rise across America that we could see. So that changed significantly in 2018. So in 2018, the FBI arrested four members of RAM and on rioting charges, you know, related to their participation at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. So the four men, included one of the co-founders at the time, were sentenced for their crimes. But at the same time, three other members of RAM, including Robert Rundo, were arrested in a separately entirely for the rally in Huntington Beach. Their charges, on the other hand, were dismissed by a district judge. Now, this is very significant because it was only after Rundo's case was dismissed that he decided, okay, he's going to now move and leave the United States because he couldn't trust his safety in the United States. He's been, you know, traveling across Eastern Europe ever since. And he thought to himself, well, okay, if we got into trouble as the Rise Above movement because we directed all the glory back to ourselves, what would happen if I take this concept of the fascist fight club that I started and instead franchise it out and decentralize it across North America? So the way he promotes his active clubs now is it's open to anybody to start an active club. So say you are a white supremacist in Oklahoma or, you know, Colorado or wherever it may be, you are now welcome to start your own active club. It has nothing to do with Robert Rundle. Sure, it's inspired and influenced by him, but by doing so, he maintains this decentralization of the system and the structure that he's building. And at the same time, is no longer liable for them. So as we see, these active clubs are evolving. So now it's not only Robert Rundle who is recruiting and radicalizing these disenfranchised youth across America. He's actually convincing other people, other ambitious, you know, white supremacist entrepreneurs, if you want to call them, to start their own clubs and to do the exact same thing, which is even more dangerous as a concept.
So he went off into exile, this Rundle character. Mostly in Eastern Europe and in Greece and Poland, Sweden, Hungary and Russia, all of these countries where you have a growing right-wing underground. And of course, in the case of Hungary, the government of Orban is an authoritarian government that recently Tucker Carlson spent a whole week broadcasting from Hungary. And that's the model for what the Republican Party is doing with voter suppression. They're following electoral authoritarianism that Orban practiced. And of course, Orban is also a kleptocrat, so it's essentially a kleptocracy. But then, of course, so is Donald Trump. And if he comes back, America will become a vast kleptocratic nation. So tell us more about the international aspect of this movement.
Well, I think you made a great point in highlighting this trend that a lot of these clubs and a lot of this exists in places where we're seeing a rise in authoritarianism and far-right politics. So based on my experience and my research, this international network we're seeing, this rise in fascist fight clubs, is taking place in countries, not necessarily countries that currently have a right-wing government or a far-right government, but countries where we're seeing these sorts of, you know, populist politics and policies on the rise, these anti-immigration policies, this Islamophobic policies, these anti-Semitic policies, any country really where we're seeing that sort of attitude permeate the mainstream society and become part of political debate and discussion, we're seeing the rise of white supremacist groups at the same time. So the examples you mentioned work perfectly here. Russia is a great example. Germany, France, as a matter of fact, because we tend to think of Eastern Europe, but we don't realize that some of the biggest culprits right now happen to be in Western Europe. Germany and France are extremely significant examples there. Italy is another great example. These are all countries that we have. Greece as well. All these countries have, the ones that don't have right-wing governments in place, are currently under the threat of rising far-right extremism. France has Marine Le Pen, for instance, on the rise. So, I cannot overstate just how significant the coronavirus pandemic has been in exacerbating all these policies and exacerbating this rise in extremism and far-right ideologies across the world, really. Because people having time to sit at home and to browse the internet and to fall into these conspiracy rabbit holes that they fall under has really helped increase people's sense of urgency of needing to participate or to do something about it. So for some people, for these young, angry men, particularly young, angry white men that we're seeing across Europe and North America, including in Canada, I've found these groups in three different places. I found them in Ottawa. I found them across other parts of Ontario as well, and in Quebec. So this is not by any means just, you know, a United States thing. This is not just by any means a Donald Trump thing. This is something that we're seeing across the world and has been exacerbated by COVID-19.
And it manifests itself in these clubs, right? These active clubs. Do they also have physical structures? Like, do they have gymnasiums and stuff like that? Or do they congregate at fitness clubs? Or are they just the pictures that you have in your article at Right Wing Watch, neo-Nazis trained for combat and growing active club movement, as an active club members posing in Colorado with their backs turned to the camera and in black hoodies with active club, holding up an active club flag. And then the guy in the middle is turning to the camera with his fist in a kind of Nazi salute.
So based on my research right now, a lot of these active clubs are brand new, and a lot of them won't be training in public locations for fear of being identified. They would prefer, a lot of the pictures that are available are at the end of the day what I call performance art. It's not necessarily, or very much, it's their political theatrics going on. It's them trying to produce these menacing photos. But it was also a great way to gain some sort of insight into what they've been able to build as a structure so far. From what I can tell, a lot of their activities take place outdoors. Even their trainings, they prefer to do outdoors. Now, this is going to be interesting when we get into the winter months and where they're going to end up congregating. That's a different story. But in the summertime, it's been there's been a whole movement for them to step outside, to do a lot of running, a lot of that kind of fitness, which is easier to do outside and is more enjoyable to do outside. And I have seen them beyond simply using gymnasiums. A big part of their agenda is to spread their propaganda. So by that I mean there's a lot of graffiti that they do. They do a lot of graffitiing and spreading these stencils and posters and pamphlets that they spread everywhere. And I've seen this occur in Colorado, Indiana, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Pittsburgh, Florida. Really goes on and on the list of different places, but they tend to work anonymously. They tend to operate at night when they're doing things like this. And when they're training during the day, they are wearing things like skull masks, etc., to cover their identities. But it's only a matter of time before they end up finding like-minded people who will offer them gyms and places to train indoors and to grow that network. What we're seeing right now is early stages. We're seeing them outside trying to find their families, find their brotherhoods, as they'd like to put it. What's going to happen in a year or two when they first, like, truly establish these locations, when we find out that there are actually, you know, secret underground fight clubs that people can attend in all these different cities where these, you know, Nazis are operating and are actually training to fight? That's going to be a lot more significant, I think.
Right. But just in closing, they also have targets, right? Antifa is one of their main targets.
I think they are going to be targeted. I think in many ways, I think Robert Rundo has learned from Rise Above movement. And I think part of that is not attacking all protests, because attacking protests and producing that kind of violence is what brings the FBI to your doorsteps, as they've learned. So it's going to be interesting to see how they choose to target people nowadays, because I am yet to see these active clubs go out and target Antifa at protests, etc., the same way we've seen the Proud Boys do, etc. So that is not exactly the case just yet. But like I said, once they are better prepared, once they have actually built their structure, what occurs? And here's another point. When you decentralize something and you secede your own leadership, well, at the same time, each different club is going to form its own identity. I'll give you a quick example here. Is that in Ontario, the club that formed there, the active club that formed there, at one point changed its name to Action 14. Now, 14, of course, going back to, you know, the 14-word slogan, white supremacist slogan that does not need any repetition on this program here. But it's safe to say that it's an extraordinarily Nazi statement to put up there. And that shows just how extreme their leaning is, even in comparison to other active clubs. So, yes, the idea that they could go out and protest and target, demonstrators of all sorts just because of their progressive values or for being liberals, etc., that's all very, very possible and on the table. It just has not occurred just yet.
Well, Karim Zidane, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ian. It was an absolute pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Karim Zidane, who's an investigative journalist who covers the intersection of sports and politics. His writing has appeared in The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Deadspin, Bleacher Report, and SB Nation. And he has an article at Right Wing Watch, Neo-Nazis Trained for Combat in Growing Active Club Movement. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. When we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by